La Jolla, California, UC San Diego Athletics presents TritonCast, the podcast for the UC San Diego Tritons. Here are your hosts, Jeff Toriel and Jenny Stevens.
Welcome to episode 49 of TritonCast, the podcast for UC San Diego Athletics. Alongside Jenny Stevens, I'm Jeff Toriel. Whether you found us on UCSTTritons.com or your favorite podcast platform, we're so happy that you've taken the time to join us this week, and you'll be glad you did. We've got another entertaining and insightful conversation coming your way.
That's definitely right, Jeff. Coming up in this week's Triton Spotlight, we'll chat with golf head coach Fred Hanover. With the team recently concluding its first Division I season, he reflects on the program's progress over the spring, including what it was like to win a tournament for the first time at the D1 level. Fred also shares some of his favorite memories from his time as a professional, touring all over the U.S. and Canada, and what it was like to start a collegiate program from scratch. Our conversation with Fred Hanover comes your way shortly in today's Triton Spotlight.
You won't want to miss that conversation. But first, we go around campus. Big congrats to coxswain Junie Kim of the rowing team. She was once again invited to participate in the U.S. Rowing Under 23 Women's National Team Selection Camp, which is just underway in Iowa. And we've officially reached the end of our first season in Division I, and what a season it was, culminating in a walk-off grand slam by Everett Lau of the baseball team and our final event of the year. So many impressive performances and memorable moments despite the challenges of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Log on to UCSDTritons.com to check out the latest team and individual academic accolades for our spring sports. It's truly impressive what our Triton Scholar athletes continue to achieve in the classroom.
So impressive. And if you haven't seen that Grand Slam video, you're definitely going to want to check that out. Now it's on to this week's Triton Spotlight. Here's our conversation with UC San Diego golf head coach, Fred Hanover.
So Fred, now that the first season of Division I golf is in the books at UC San Diego, how would you assess the experience, the team's performance, and so on?
Boy, it was a very strange experience. As we all know, the coronavirus really put a wrench in, you know, all of our, you know, plans and development and so on and so forth. So at the end of the day, I'm pretty thankful that we even had, you know, part of a season. We had half the team were new players. And again, it just kind of slowed our development a little bit, not being able to play in the fall. Being able to play a little bit in the spring was nice. But like I said, at the end of the day, we were just thankful to play a little bit. We didn't have the best season we had, although we did win the last tournament that we played in. So that was fun. But I'm hoping that next year is more close to normal and we have a lot better year next year.
You talked about the fall and not being able to get out on the course often because of the pandemic, and we'll certainly kind of get into those specifics, but the tournaments that you did play in the spring, you just mentioned the team was able to win the final one, the St. Mark Invitational here in the San Diego area. How would you kind of assess the team's progress and growth over the course of the spring?
I was really pleased. The first three tournaments that we played in, we got last place. Now, there was a whole bunch of factors that led to that. For example, when we played at UC Irvine, we had to commute each day. We didn't get to stay overnight. So the guys had to get up at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Then when we went to Cal Baptist tournament, same kind of thing. We had to commute and we had even had to get up earlier because that's 20 miles further Riverside was. So the first few tournaments were just unbelievably challenging. And again, like I said, you know, three times now that we were just thankful to be able to play. So we played, but it didn't quite go as well as we would have liked. You know, then we were fortunate we got to play in Santa Barbara, which we got to do kind of a normal tournament where we traveled and stayed overnight and played a practice round. And, you know, we finished 7th out of 10 teams, which was a big improvement over getting last place. And then we had a small tournament at St. Mark, which was really cool. It was Northridge, Riverside, and us. And we were able to prevail over the course of the three rounds. Again, winning is always exciting. Many of the guys played extremely well. We had, you know, two guys tie for second. And, you know, it was really a great experience. It was nice that way to finish the season that way. And hopefully that will help, you know, jumpstart us for next season. They'll be a little more motivated to work on their games over the summer and be ready to go in the fall.
I think it's very interesting what you mentioned about early this spring, the team traveling to Cal Baptist, traveling to Irvine and having to commute back and forth, not being able to stay, not wanting to be in a hotel. I know there were so many different protocols put into place for safety, even for the two tournaments that you hosted. What kinds of things went into it behind the scenes that most of us wouldn't even know about?
Wow. It was very challenging for the, you know, for us to even host two tournaments. We had to make sure, for example, that the golf course adhered to all the protocols of social distancing and masking and so on and so forth. We had to make sure the restaurant did the same thing. All the food had to be to go. Nobody could stay and eat. And, you know, we have 20 to 25 total players and coaches eating all their meals. And then we had a host hotel. Same thing, had to make sure that the cleaning protocols were all met. And then a committee had to approve us after I got all the information about the protocols being adhered to. And it just took a long time. Whereas normally I just set a schedule and, you know, we do our travel and we go and play our tournament. But this year, you know, we did not want anybody to get sick. And again, we talked about this earlier. I thought it was okay that I thought it was a really good idea that we were, you know, very strict in our adherence to the coronavirus policies, because if one person got sick or one person, God forbid, died, it would have been just a tragedy beyond what we could imagine. And since it was somewhat avoidable by doing the necessary things to make sure that the hotel was clean, the restaurant was clean, that we were clean at the golf course, we were allowed to host a tournament if we did all those things. And so we did all those things and were able to host. And we had two nice tournaments, one at La Costa and one at St. Mark. And again, we were fortunate enough to win at St. Mark. So again, we were thankful just to be playing.
Maybe an unfair question given the circumstances because of the coronavirus, but now that the program has been through a year, albeit a different year in Division One, what kinds of differences are there between D1 golf and D2 golf?
The D1 golf programs are deeper. Again, the top players from Division II can play Division I golf. I've coached at all levels, Division I, II, III, and NAIA. The Division II golfers, the best ones, could play at Division I. But at the Division I level, you know, the really good teams are 5, 6, 7, and 8 players deep. And that's the huge difference when your number 5 player is just about as good as your number 1 player, which you don't really see at the lower levels. And that's where we really have to get better, is we have to our guys have to work a little harder, be a little more focused and committed, and then get it so we're 7 or 8 deep. And then when we're 7 or 8 deep, you know, we'll be as competitive as anybody.
I imagine that changes the way you recruit now in terms of what you're looking for in a scholar athlete.
Yes, definitely. Obviously, the most important thing is that they have the academics to get into the school, which are very demanding at UCSD. And so assuming they have the academics, now I want somebody who is constantly playing and working on their games, not just playing junior golf tournaments, but playing amateur golf tournaments, United States Golf Association events, professional events, if they can qualify for them. I want guys that are playing at the highest possible level that they can play in. And when at the point that we get 7 or 8 guys all doing that, again, we'll be a really competitive team at the Division I level.
I want to go back now to last year, the program's final season of Division II, a very successful campaign in the CCAA, of course, before it was cut short due to the pandemic. The team was nationally ranked. You were ultimately the conference coach of the year. Why was that team so successful?
That team was a really special group of guys. I got the job halfway through the year before, and they hadn't had a very good fall season. They finished near the bottom of most tournaments. And when I got here, I noticed that, you know what, these guys are pretty good and they're talented and they really have desire to succeed. And so we got a Todd Bannister helped get us a home course. And I enlisted the help of a sports psychologist. And then I used my experience as a coach and player to help them. And lo and behold, they played spectacular in the spring of that first year. And the interesting thing was is 20 teams went to regionals that first year, and we were the 20th team, and four went on to NC2As. And going into the final round of the regional championship, we were in third place. And the guys played the best round of their life and shot 13 under par, and we ended up getting second place and going to the NCAA championships. And it was such a special group, and we finished 14th at the NCAA championships. So coming into the next year, we had everybody back except one guy, and we had somebody in the wings to replace him. And so we were ready to go. We finished second in Hawaii. We won the tournament, the Cal State San Marcos tournament in February. And then lo and behold, March came and, you know, the season was shut down. But that team, I truly believe, could have really done some real good work at the NCAA championship had we been allowed to go. We were already going to be in the regional, so I think we would have been able to get through that. And who knows what would have happened. We had a mentally tough group. They were talented players. Their work ethic was fantastic. And again, you just don't always see that. And they were mostly seniors. And so their season was shut down, which was disappointing to all of them. But again, they graduated, got degrees. One of them is my assistant coach now. The other three are playing professionally on the minor league tour and trying to be professional golfers. And so again, I still stay in contact with all of them. And it's really a special, special group. And I'm just thankful that I had the opportunity to coach them, because they did such a good job that it probably helped me keep my job. So that was really, I'm indebted to them for that.
What was your message to the team when the season abruptly ended?
Well, at the time, we didn't think that, you know, it was going to last as long as it was going to last. We thought it might be a month. And so I said, you know, if the golf courses are open, you guys can play. Otherwise, please be safe, because we didn't really understand, you know, how it got transmitted or how serious the virus was. And so, you know, it just basically be safe. And if you can get out and practice a little bit, do that and keep up with your studies. But we didn't really know. And so then, you know, after a couple of months, it became obvious that it was way more serious than we thought at the beginning, that our season was going to be canceled. Then, you know, they had the opportunity to come back the following year. And I had talks with each and every one of them. They could have played this year, because the NCAA granted the athletes an extra year of eligibility, those that were affected by the coronavirus. And each and every one of them were ready to move on with their lives. And I can't disagree with that. I would have thought the only reason to stay an extra year in school would be if you're going to work on an advanced degree or a second major or something like that. But if you were just going to stay to play golf, you know, it was time for them time for you to move on with your life. And so they each decided that, yeah, you know what, it was time to move on with our lives. And they did. And they're thriving. Some of them mini tour professionals. And like I said, the one young man is Jacob Johnson is my assistant coach now.
And for those who weren't graduating, it wouldn't be leaving, it would be returning this year. How were they able to practice and stay in shape while courses were closed and everything last summer?
Boy, well, the courses were mostly closed in April and May. And then at some point, it was kind of figured out that the golf course is a pretty naturally socially distant outdoor place. And so the golf industry since, you know, last summer has experienced a growth that it's never experienced ever, because golf became one of the activities that you could do safely. So, you know, most of the guys went to their homes over summer and practiced at their courses, and were able to have some level of practice and training in while we were waiting for the virus to subside. And again, even after a few months, you never would have thought that now, last summer, that would still, there'd still be, some effects of the virus still remaining in May of 2021. So again, they probably thought that, the fall was going to be fairly normal. So they got to practice a little bit, and then, we come back to school in the fall and basically we're shut down. We can't go play any tournaments. We could do some training, physical training, and we could do some practice on the golf course, which we had a lot of inter-squad matches and inter-squad tournaments. I'm sure they got sick of each other and sick of doing that, but it really was the only way to stay active during the time. And so we, I instituted a point system, and it was fun to at least get to know each other, because it was a new team, and play a little bit of competition against each other. But it wasn't the same as traveling and playing, against other universities at tournaments. But again, we were in the middle of a pandemic, so we just did the best we could given the circumstances that we were in.
Golf coach Fred Hanover, our guest this week on TritonCast. Let's go back to the year prior to that. So 2 years ago, you mentioned the team making an NCAA Division II championship appearance, but that was also the year you took over as interim coach in January. So just before the start of the spring season. How did you get the job, and what was that experience like?
That's I always enjoy this, because the team did so well. I enjoy these kind of questions. What happened was the coach abruptly left for a job in Monterey, and I live in San Marcos, which is, 30 miles or so from UCSD. And a friend of mine called me on the phone one day in December saying, "Hey, Fred, did you know the UC San Diego job is vacant?" I said, "No, I had no idea." So I did some research and I found that it was. And the irony was 5 years earlier, when the coach that had just left got the job, he and I were the two finalists, and he got the job and I didn't. And so now this time I was determined that I was going to get the job. And so right away I got a resume and references to the athletic director and the associate athletic director. They did an interview, and lo and behold, I was fortunate enough to get the job. And the interesting thing was I, like I said before, I looked at the team and I thought, these guys are pretty good. So I decided to be bold when I first met them and said, "Okay, you guys, I know you had a struggle in the fall, but we're going to win the national championship this year." And they probably looked at me like I had three heads. However, I think they liked the change of atmosphere, the culture, and everything else. And they thought, "Hey, okay, you know what? We got a new home course. We have a new coach. Let's kind of have a clean start and let's see what happens." And lo and behold, the first tournament we were in contention to win. And then that even made me more confident that these guys were good, that not only the fall was a kind of a fluke, that these guys could really achieve a lot. So again, we continued to develop. We worked with a sports psychologist. I worked with them on short game and playing more intelligently on the golf course, and things I have experience with because of from my professional playing days. And they just kept getting better and better. And we finished fourth at conference, which got us the 20th spot in the region. And again, I'm sure that the teams that were in the region with us thought, UC San Diego, how'd they even get here? They're the 20th ranked team. They're not going anywhere when only four advance. But again, they did such a great job at the regional, and the last round shooting 13 under par as a team was an amazing feat. But it just seemed like that round, all of the things that we had gone over, the short game work, the course management work, the work with the sports psychologist, all those things just kind of blossomed in that final round at the region. And then going to nationals was an absolute blast. We missed getting into the match play because they play the top eight teams advance and to a match play. So they play one against one. And again, we finished 14th, and boy, it was close, but it was a great trip. A lot of the parents and families came. It was in Glade Springs, West Virginia. So it was a ways away. And again, the support that we had from, you know, Todd, the department, the families, it was a really special team, a special group. And I'll, you know, never forget, you know, what they accomplished.
What an incredible story for sure. When you first took over in January, how did you assess each individual and where they needed to improve?
Well, I needed to do that rather quickly because we had a tournament in 3 weeks. And so we just started playing and qualifying, and I watched them play. I played with them a little bit and just kind of figured out, you know, where they were. In my experience of coaching, most guys have, they work on their swings. They want to hit the ball far. I mean, they're 18-year-old guys with a lot of testosterone, so they want to hit it far, which is only natural. So I kind of figured they probably needed work on chipping and putting and just playing a little bit smarter. And so that's where I attacked attack their games at that point, is helping them become smarter players and have better short games. And lo and behold, they really embraced all of it. And then their talents came out and they were just so excited to, I think, have a better culture and better atmosphere that they just blossomed. I mean, I could, you know, by the end of the season, I could just watch and they already knew what to do. And as a coach, that's the best feeling in the world, when you trust all the guys on your team that they're doing the best they possibly can, and that whatever happens, happens, but it's not for lack of effort and not lack of understanding what they need to do to be successful. It just didn't quite work out at the end. But again, 14th out of whatever 280 teams is a really good place to finish, especially where they had begun the season. And I couldn't have been more pleased. And the second year could have been a championship season had it not been cut short for the coronavirus.
That's such a great story. And clearly the team had a lot of success right off the bat as soon as you arrived. But did you have any moments of doubt when you first took over? Oh goodness, what did I get myself into?
Well, I had to look at it this way. I'm the interim coach. I better do the best job I can possibly do, or I'm going to permanently be the interim coach and somebody else is going to be the permanent coach. So I thought I'd just go bold and just tell them, you know what, you guys can win the national championship this year. And I thought by saying that, they now, instead of, you know, having their heads down a little bit and feeling bad about what happened in the fall, it's like, God, we got a new a breath of fresh air, and we have somebody new in here that believes in us and that thinks we can be good. And so I just think that from that moment on, I think they really liked that confidence that I showed in them. And again, I'm a poker player, so that was almost a bluff, because I had to do something, because again, I could see that, like, you know, they were looking at me and I'm looking at them and like, who is this guy? And so what, you know, he probably doesn't know much. So I had to come up with something. And I read somewhere, somebody had said that maybe somebody like Pat Riley or Phil Jackson, who I've read both of their books more than one time, said something like that. And I thought, you know what, it's time for a bold statement. And, you know, it turned out to be perfect, because it was just what the guys, those, that team needed in order to thrive. And like I said, I feel so fortunate that I got to be coach of those guys. And even to this day, I mean, I talk to many of them regularly, and some of them have been out of school 2 years and some of them out of school 1 year. And like I said, I have good relationships with them. And that's really what makes this job really cool, is that I have relationships with men and women that I coached 10 or 15 years ago or 25 years ago. And so that part's really cool to me too. I've been to weddings. I've seen, you know, babies, seen, you know, women that have played for me have children. One of them, you know, sends their child to my camp. So it's pretty fun to be involved with this age, because of the relationships that you make.
Yeah, I know you've taught and coached collegiately for well over two decades now. How has the game changed?
Boy, that's another question I love to answer. When I first started, nobody hit the ball as far as they hit it today. The technology of the golf clubs and the golf ball and the fact that men and women are both in much better shape physically than they were 20 or 25 years ago has significantly changed the game. Whereas in the past, you know, on most golf holes, as a coach, I would want, you know, people to play conservatively. Now, I really want them to play aggressively because the drivers are so well made in 2021 and 2020 that the ball goes pretty straight, and the technology of the golf ball helps it go straight. And so now you can play very aggressively on holes that you wouldn't have played aggressively 25 years ago when there was trouble, because the technology is so good that the ball goes straight. And the guys on my team and on all the other teams too have mostly fundamentally sound swings. And so those swings will produce pretty straight shots. And so just imagine now, instead of, you know, playing a hole with a four iron where you'd only hit it 200 yards or 180 yards, you can now hit a driver and have no fear that it's going to go crooked, and you can hit it 300 yards. So you're going to be a lot closer to the green. The scores are going to be better. And I had to adjust my coaching, and probably 5 or 6 years ago, I just kind of, it hit me with a ton of bricks. Like, you know what? The technology's so good, we don't need to play safe anymore. And so I really encourage my teams to play aggressively. And the funny thing is that, you know, I'm in my 50s, and the guys on my team are 18 to 22. And what really makes me kind of giggle is when I want them to be more aggressive than they want to be, because that shouldn't be a natural thing if someone in their 50s shouldn't want, you know, shouldn't be more aggressive than an 18 to 20 year old that's full of testosterone and wants to hit as far as they can. But there are times when I want them to play more aggressively than they want to play. And so I think I know I'm coming along with the time, because I've adjusted my coaching to have them now be much more aggressive than I did, you know, 10 or 15 years ago.
That's fantastic. I know you've coached at a number of places, and you mentioned earlier your experience in D2, D3, NAIA, but I want to specifically talk about Cal State San Marcos, where you coached in the late 90s and early 2000s. You helped start that program. How do you start a program from scratch? And where do you begin?
That brings back mostly good memories. What happened was I was coaching at Cal State San Bernardino, and I was a part-time coach making a part-time salary. And a woman who was assistant to the president from Cal State San Marcos called me one day and started inquiring about golf. And she said, "Hey, would you answer a few questions for me?" And I said, "Sure." And I answered a few questions for her, and she said, "Thank you very much," and then hung up. And about 2 weeks later, she called me back. And about twice a month for 4 or 5 months, she kept calling me, asking me questions about starting a golf program. And so finally, she said, "You know, at Cal State San Marcos, we're thinking about starting athletics, and we want to start with golf." She said, "Would you know anybody who would be interested in coaching the team?" And I said, "Well, is it a full-time position?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "You are talking to somebody who's interested in coaching the team," because I was just getting married at the time, and I needed a full-time job. And I thought it would be nice to live, you know, in North San Diego County. I'd never lived here before. I'd obviously driven through and been here, but I'd never spent much time here. And so lo and behold, I'm now the men's and women's golf coach at Cal State San Marcos with a full-time job. And the best part is we got to create the program from scratch. So we got somebody to help out with compliance. I did some recruiting. We had a little bit of scholarship money, and we funded, we got it going right away, because the first year, much like, you know, we're on probation, not probation for a bad reason, but probation from being in the postseason, because we're moving into Division One. When your first year at NAIA, you weren't allowed to compete in the postseason, and the plan at San Marcos was to add more sports. And so we wanted to start golf, and I had 2 months to get the program going. We wanted to start golf immediately so we could serve the probation, because it's just a university probation. So all the teams that came following the following year could compete for national championship if they were able to do so. So we put together the team in 2 months, had a pretty good team. It was a lot of fun. I had a great bunch of guys on that team. And again, this is 23 years ago, and I still am close friends with a couple of guys that played on that team. The following year, we started women's golf. And for the next 10 or 12 years, it was a fantastic experience and being a part of that Cal State San Marcos program. And then a new administration came in, and there were some problems, and they eliminated the coaching job, the full-time coaching job, and made it a part-time job. And here I was, a married person, and I needed the benefits and so on and so forth, and I just couldn't do it anymore. I left Cal State San Marcos and applied numerous places. I interviewed in Charlotte, North Carolina, Pleasant Hill, Michigan, all over the place. UC San Diego one time, and I didn't get the job. Finally, I got a job at University of Redlands, which is 90 miles from my house, making $12,000 a year. So I coached there for 3 years, and then finally, I just couldn't do it anymore. They kept saying they were going to make it a full-time position, but it never came true. So 1 year I went in for my, the 6 months before I got the job at UCSD, I go in for my evaluation, and I asked the athletic director if they're going to make it a full-time job. And he said they were not. So I stood up and shook his hand and said, thank you for the opportunity, and hoped that something better would come along, which it certainly did. And so, like I said, I'm so glad and thankful to be coaching at UCSD. I cannot tell you how happy I am to be here, and that it all worked out the way it did. Except I'm just really happy to be here.
Well, we're very happy to have you, and glad that it worked out, and appreciate your persistence for sure. I do want to go back to the San Marcos job for just a moment. I think you raised an interesting point that you started the program from scratch, and a year later, women's program was added. What differences are there between the men's and women's game?
Oh, that's such a fun, again, you ask me all kinds of fun questions.
I try.
golf is golf. But the difference is that, and this could get me in trouble with some of the guys, but 18 to 21 year old women are more mature than 18 to 21 year old men. And so, for example, when I wanted them to practice, the women's team to practice a certain way, they did it. They understood that I played professionally, that I knew what I was talking about, and they just did it. The guys questioned it all the time. Oh, why do we want to do this? We don't need to do this. And so it took a little while for them, for their level of maturity to catch up to the women. Same when we traveled. When I traveled with the women, they didn't need an alarm clock to get up. They were at breakfast at the right time. They were ready to go. The guys, sometimes I had to knock on their doors and wake them up. They couldn't get up in the morning. And again, it's just that I think nobody would argue that 18 to 21 year old women are more mature than 18 to 21 year old men.
That's so interesting. Going back to your time as a golfer, when did you start playing golf?
Well, I started when I was like 11 or 12 years old, and I'm a sports fanatic even to this day. I always wanted to be a professional athlete, and I wasn't that great in baseball, and I wasn't that great in basketball. And I found, golf. I went to the golf course with my dad or my grandfather, and I found a sport where you could kind of go at your own pace. If you wanted to be really good, you just practice more. You didn't have to wait for a team. You didn't have to wait for a coach. You could just go to the golf course and practice, and which I did. And I was fortunate enough to play college golf at UC Irvine. And then I turned pro, and I had a stellar pro career, Jeff. I made $100,000 and I spent $300,000. And did you know that as an adult, you're supposed to make more money than you spend?
I've heard that that's a thing. Yes.
Now, anyway, so I had kind of a mediocre professional career. And that's basically how I got started coaching, is that I thought that I had to find something in the field of athletics. And I figured, geez, I've had a limited success playing golf, but boy, I understand, the adversity, going through the adversity. And I thought maybe I'd be a good coach. And I always liked, basketball coaches. Pat, again, I've read Pat Riley. Riley's books and Phil Jackson's books. And so I really took a lot. I tried to relate that to golf, and I took a lot from that. And lo and behold, I got the job, you know, got the coaching job at Cal State San Bernardino. And, you know, we have the rest. One more post to my golf career. 7 years ago, I was fortunate enough that I qualified and played in the Senior U.S. Open, which was really, really exciting. And the funny part about that is that I played horribly at the tournament. I finished almost in last place.
And oh, no.
The irony of all ironies is that I got $2,000 just for playing. And then TaylorMade, who sponsored me at the time, gave me another $1,000. So I actually played the worst I'd ever played and made $3,000, which I never profited like that when during my playing career.
Where was the Senior Open that year?
It was in Oklahoma City.
How much does weather, geography, those kinds of things play a role in being successful or not on the course for an individual?
Well, if you can play in wind or bad weather, it's going to definitely benefit you. And that's a problem, because we live in San Diego where the weather's perfect 360 days a year. So one of the things that I do is make sure that on any day that it's even remotely inclement, like under 60 degrees, I know the people in the back east still think that's hilarious, under 60 degrees, that we get out and play. If it's a little bit drizzly or rainy, we play. If it's windy, we play. Now, it's not that many days that we do that, but I don't cancel practice or playing unless the golf course is closed, because I know that at some point in time, we're going to play in bad conditions in tournament, and we have to at least have some experience in playing with it. But that's one of my biggest challenges as a coach, is that now what do I do when we travel to, you know, Colorado for a tournament, like what we're going to do in the fall, and all of a sudden, you know, it's 30-mile-an-hour winds and it's 45 degrees. My guys are going to freak out. And so, again, if we can just play a few times in inclement weather, at least kind of have some comfort in it, and hopefully it'll turn out okay. But, man, that is a big, big challenge for us living in San Diego.
No question about that. Fred Hanover, our guest on TritonCast, he mentioned going to Colorado in the fall. I think that stoked an interesting question. What about altitude? That's got to affect how far the ball travels, right? So does that affect approach?
Yes, it does. It depends how high you go. And we're supposed to be going in the fall, pending approval, is Fort Collins, which is about a mile high. So the ball will travel somewhere between 10 and 15% further at that kind of elevation. And so you really have to adjust, you know, your shots, because or else you'd hit everything over the green. So as we go, the guys will all know that. But when we play the practice round, we'll really kind of have to get a feel of how far the ball is exactly going. Because let's say the normal guy hits an 8-iron 170 yards. He may hit it closer to 185 or 190 yards. And it's like, whoa, I'm hitting an 8-iron 190 yards. But then they have to realize that everybody's doing it. And so just kind of, you know, get some comfort in doing that, rather than just be so shocked and surprised that, oh, my 8-iron's going 190 yards. Everybody's 8-iron's going 190 yards. So once they kind of get used to it, which hopefully will happen in the practice round, we'll be fine.
Yeah, I would think, too, for schools in Colorado, Colorado State, those kind of schools in that part of the country, if they were to come here and play, it would obviously have the opposite effect, which would take an adjustment on their part.
Yep, that was certainly true. They're going to hit it a little bit shorter. So I haven't really thought about that much. But yeah, if they come to our tournament next year, we got some teams from Utah coming. So I'm sure there's some elevation there too. So yeah, they're going to hit it shorter.
Fred, tell me a little bit about the team aspect of golf. I know golf by nature is an individual sport, right? But at the collegiate level, there's the team aspect, which is critically important to have success as a group. How does one scholar athlete's success or struggles affect the team overall? And how do you as a coach kind of manage that?
Well, it's really important that, especially since we travel and stay overnight together, that we're all respectful of each other's individual, let's say, quirks, and that we can get along overnight, get along going to meals, get along in travel. All those things are really, really important. And we at UCSD have a really special group. It's really difficult just to get admitted to UCSD. So most of the people on my team are more mature than the average students. And so I haven't had any problems with them on the road or being respectful of one another, or, you know, not if they don't get to go to the restaurant of their first choice, nobody complains. They just go ahead and eat and find something on the menu that they like. Little things like that, when guys are complaining or whatever they're doing and not going along with what the team is doing, can drive little holes and little cracks in a team. And we do our best to make sure that we talk before we leave, like, hey, this is where we're going to go. This is what we're going to do. Is everybody okay with it? And then we try to get to a point where everybody is okay with what we're doing. And so, again, no cracks while we're traveling. The other thing that's difficult is that before we go to a tournament, I have to determine who gets to play. And I don't subjectively pick who's going to play most of the time. Most of the time, we have an inner squad match to see who the best players are on any given day, and those guys will travel. So in addition to being mature when they travel together, they are playing against each other in qualifying, and which is a very interesting thing because only five or six travel, and there could be up to 10 or 11 on the team. And so that means four or five of the guys in the qualifying will not get to travel. And sometimes the qualifiers are extremely close, like one shot difference between, you know, taking a nice trip. For example, we went to Hawaii the last year, and, you know, a couple shots difference, different guys would have gone to Hawaii. And so they have to accept the fact that, hey, sometimes somebody's going to beat me. And so they're all respectful of each other during qualifying. In fact, I saw one guy one time make a horrible mistake on the last hole, and it cost him going to a tournament. And he took off his hat when he was done. He shook the hand of the guy that beat him and said, hey, you know, do a great job at the tournament. And so that is the kind of character a lot of times that golf breeds. There's no, you know, there's no cheating. There's no trying to bend the rules. And so they've all been brought up playing junior golf, playing amateur golf. And so they know that, you know, on good days they're going to win, but sometimes somebody else on their team or somebody else down the road is going to beat them. And so it's really important that you, especially to your teammates, that you shake their hand, wish them well, and, you know, say, okay, you know what, I'm going to do better next time. And maybe the next time it'll be that person's time to qualify. So it's really important that you have that kind of culture on the team where people are respectful of one another. Because if you don't, I mean, as you can imagine, if you're traveling in close quarters with five or six other people, it can be a nightmare if, you know, people aren't getting along, or they don't want a room together, or they don't want to go to dinner, or whatever other, you know, distractions can happen. You just don't want that, because it will leak onto the golf course, those kinds of distractions. And we don't want to get any cracks like that. We need to stay together, and staying together helps us root for the one another when we're playing in competition, and root for one another when we're playing against one another, because at the end of the day, we're all on the UCSD golf team.
Oh, that's so true. I love that. From a coaching perspective, once a round is underway in a tournament, what kind of adjustments can you realistically make with an individual?
There's a lot of different ways and techniques that we've incorporated over the years. Sometimes, you know, me or my assistant coach will walk or go along and basically caddy for one of the players on the team for 9 holes or for 18 holes or sometimes 36 or 54 holes. And just to make sure that they are doing what they're supposed to be doing. Other times you go in certain spots of the course where you think you can be helpful to everybody and you watch everybody play. For example, let's say the fourth hole is a hole where it would be, you know, they might need some help. I would just go to sit on the fourth hole and help all 5 or 6 guys go through the fifth hole. It's just all kinds of different ways we can coach. It just depends on the team. It depends on the individual. Some guys like it when I'm around and I'm reading their putts and getting their and giving my opinion on what they should be hitting on certain shots. And other guys really want to do it on their own. And again, as long as they are giving their best effort, they know how to manage the course on certain holes and what to do, it's totally fine. Excuse me. It's totally fine that they want to do it on their own because they've been doing it on their own, you know, since junior golf. So I'm not ever offended if somebody wants to do it on their own. However, I'm there and my assistant coach is there to help them if they would like the help.
Let's go back to your playing days. You said you went to Irvine. I know you graduated in 1985. You were team MVP in 1984. Why did you choose UC Irvine?
Well, I liked my first year of college, I went to UC Davis. And let's just say, like I was talking about the maturity level of some the 18 to 21 year old, I let's say lacked a lot of maturity when I was 18 years old. And I didn't do so well academically. So year two, I went to a community college, made up classes, and then I had to kind of figure out, you know, where I was going to go from there. And UC Irvine offered me a partial scholarship, a golf scholarship. They played good courses. They played a good schedule. It was a UC school. I had kind of redeemed myself academically by that time. And so I thought it would be a good fit for me to go to school there. And I was really happy that I went to school there. We played a good schedule. We had nice home courses to play. And some of my teammates, you know, from 35 years ago are still my friends to this day, which is really cool to me. And so again, UC Irvine ended up being a really good fit, but it took a little while for me to get there. I needed to do that, the terrible thing we call maturing. So as soon as I was mature, I thrived at UC Irvine.
It takes all of us different amounts of time to get there. And some of us are still working on it. So then you started playing professionally. How did that come about? And what are some of your favorite memories of your time on the tour?
Well, when I graduated, I had to kind of figure out what I wanted to do. And I was I was a good golfer. I wasn't sure if I was good enough to play professionally. So, but I decided to give it a shot. So I played the minor league circuit, made obviously a little bit of money, but didn't really make enough to make a living. I was a substitute teacher also. So that's always funny, funny stories about substitute teaching. And so just to make enough money to pay rent. And then I would go off and play. And then the second summer after I had turned pro, I qualified for the Canadian Tour, which is now the PGA Tour of Canada. It's like, it'd be the equivalent to like double or triple A baseball. And I played many years on the Canadian Tour. I had some really good finishes. I met nice people. I always think back to one tournament in particular where I was in fourth place going into the final round. And I shot a 65, which is a fantastic score. Unfortunately, the guys that were in front of me in first, second, third shot about 65, 66, 67. And so I couldn't pass them. The fifth place person was 7 or 8 strokes behind me. And I just wonder to this day, had the guys, you know, playing that day shot, you know, even par instead of 66 or 67, how my life would have been different. I would have made $40,000 or $50,000 instead of $8,000 or $10,000 in the one shot. I would have won a tournament, got exemptions. It might have, helped my confidence. Who knows what would have happened? I look back and not with much regret, just, you know, think, oh, you know what? God, I was close to maybe doing something really good.
What are some of your favorite courses that you've played?
I really enjoyed, there's a lot of nice courses in the Toronto area. The National's a nice course. There's a course called the Devil's Pulpit, which was, and the Devil's, Devil's Pulpit, which was created by the people that made Trivial Pursuit. They made so much money at Trivial Pursuit, the Canadian guys, that they built a golf course. And so, wow. And they built an outstanding golf course in the Toronto area. I played in tournaments in Prince Edward Island, which is at the time a whole day. I drove the entire tour too. So the first tournament, for example, in May, wow. In Victoria. And if you know the Canadian geography at all, the last tournament was in Prince Edward Island, which is a whole day drive to Maine. And then I yep. drove back to California from there. And Jeff, you learned some important things. Like, did you know that the long version of Freebird is longer than the long version of Stairway to Heaven? I bet you didn't know that.
I did not know that, but I will make sure that I retain that. That's awesome. I mean,
you're hours and hours and hours in the car. And obviously, you know, you got time to listen to the radio. You're doing whatever it is you're doing. In that time, I've been to 25 different baseball stadiums. I got to see some CFL, you know, Canadian Football League games. So I really got to experience a lot of different culture. And many of us in the U.S. don't really even, you know where Canada is or anything about Canada. So it's always fun when I meet somebody in California that's from Canada and they tell me where, and I know exactly where it is. And I've been there a lot of times, and they like you're the only person that even knows where Canada is. And so I just laugh. And I think that's the funniest thing. So my golf career fortunately took me to a lot of really cool places. And many times I drove, and I'll tell you one more story. One time I had a week off from the Canadian tour, and I was going to go play a tournament, the Maine State Open in Portland, Maine. And it was a Saturday night, and I'm driving. I'm a couple hundred miles away, and I stopped at like 5 o'clock at night to get a hotel. And there were no vacancies. So I think, oh, that's weird. So, but I got back in the car, drove a little ways away, got off the freeway, no vacancies, kept driving, no vacancies. I end up getting to driving the entire 200 miles. And I get to Portland, Maine, you know, 9, 10 o'clock at night, stop at a hotel. They said, sir, there's no vacancies within 100 miles of any direction. So now it's 10 o'clock at night and I don't know what to do. So what do? I figure out where the golf course is. I drive and I go into the parking lot and I sleep in the back of my car. Wake up the next, I had hotel reservations starting the next night. Wake up the next morning, had breakfast, went to my hotel. And the next day I played a practice round and I got paired with people that lived in the area. They were teachers that were off for the summer. And one of the teachers and I became friends during that round, and he offered to caddy for me. Well, he caddied for me, and I finished fourth place in the tournament. I shot 68, 69, 68, which is really good scores, and won a couple, $2,000-$3,000. He would not take a dime. And at the time, $2,000-$3,000 winning for me, even today, that would be fantastic. But at the time, you know, 30 years ago, was just a huge payday for me. And so it was really exciting. And to think I started the first night sleeping in the car in the parking lot of a golf course.
That's bananas. Did you ever figure out or get a reason why everything was sold out?
Yes. It was a Saturday night in August, you know, along the coast in Maine, and it's a huge tourist time. But me yep. being from California, I had no idea that, you know, it would be like that. So how would I even have known that? And so, you know, by the time I figured it out, it was too late. And, you know, I just, one night in the back of the car, the golf course, it wasn't going to kill me. So I just went and did it. And like I said, woke up and had breakfast at the course and checked in. And it was actually turned out to be a great week when it at the beginning didn't look like it was going to be a very good week.
That's a great story. We're in our final moments with Fred Hanover on Triton Cast this week. How often do you still play?
I play with the guys on the team occasionally. To be a really good golfer takes a lot of time, energy, and commitment. And I have my mediocre prime is way past. So I just play a little bit with the guys of the team. And once in a while I'll play with, you know, I have two children. I'll play with them once in a while. Or friends or family once in a while, but really my playing career is pretty much over. And I'm just basically just a full-time coach now, which again, I still go on the golf course with the team. And once in a while I beat them, but I'm not much of a player anymore.
What's the most beautiful course you've ever been to?
Boy, that's a very difficult question. Cypress Point is spectacular. The course is immaculate. It's in Carmel on the 17-mile drive. You see the ocean most of the time, and it's really, really exclusive. Private, and so it's very difficult to get on. And I've been fortunate enough to play there a few times. There used to actually be a tournament I played in there. That you can't really get much more beautiful than that. More of a public course. I love Edgewood and Lake Tahoe. The big trees, lake. It's absolutely beautiful. Also, and then if you want to go north of the border, if you go to Banff, I don't know if you've ever been to Banff Springs, but the golf courses in Banff are just beautiful. Kind of reminds me of Lake Tahoe with the big trees and the lake. And it's just really a pretty, they're all beautiful. I wouldn't want to have to choose between them.
Alberta is on my list for sure. It looks like a very beautiful place.
Banff area is spectacular. It's just a beautiful place, and it's even nice in the wintertime. Obviously they have skiing and stuff, so it's beautiful winter or summer.
And last question, the very most difficult course you've ever played.
The course I played for the Senior U.S. Open, which is called Oak Tree National, I think was probably the most difficult course. I just couldn't get my bearings on the course, and just my scores were terrible. And it was a difficult course. Obviously, my game, I was, you know, in my 50s, and so my game wasn't, you know, like it was when I was in my 20s. And so just that combination, the course was so, so difficult that I was double bogeying, you know, half the holes. So that course really proved to be a really difficult one for me. I'm sure there might be courses that are as difficult or more, but as far as like me remembering a competitive situation where I was just way overwhelmed by the golf course, that sticks out in my mind more than anything.
Fred, this has been a lot of fun. We'll have to have you back on for some more war stories. This is great.
I got a few more. So thank you for having me, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
Wow, Jeff, what a great conversation with Fred. And that story of him sleeping in his car was so crazy. I mean, I feel like as sports fans and even people working in sports, sometimes we forget about the little behind the scenes stuff like travel and where are you going to stay and other things that people have to figure out when they're playing professional sports.
Absolutely. And I mean, knowing Fred as we do, we can totally picture him doing that and then going out on the course and being successful as well. I love that. I found it interesting, you know, looking at his career arc and all of the places that he's been from a coaching perspective beyond his playing career and over at Cal State San Marcos, for instance, starting the program, starting a women's team, what that must have been like to go through that process and how that's then helped him along the way and ultimately how, as he wound his way and ended up here at UC San Diego, taking over, you know, weeks before the start of the spring season.
Yeah, it sure seems like every stop along in his career, he's really progressed the program that he's been with, just leaps and bounds, which is amazing. And we are definitely so fortunate to have him here at UC San Diego.
That's a great point, Jenny. And we've seen that here with the progress that this program has made. And as we noted, and we talked about him winning, or the team winning their first Division I tournament at the end of the year. Really cool stuff.
Definitely.
Well, you won't want to miss an all new episode of TritonCast next week. We're back. It's hard to believe we're up to episode 50. And to celebrate the milestone, we'll bring back the guest from our very first episode, UC San Diego Athletics Director, Earl Edwards. We'll chat about his leadership during the pandemic, guiding the Tritons through their first Division I season. And we've got a special surprise that you won't want to miss. New episodes of TritonCast premiere each Wednesday.
I can't believe it's already episode 50. So crazy. Thank you so much for listening to this week's show. If you like what you heard, subscribe, rate the show, and write us a brief review. It would mean a lot to us. And don't forget, you can find us on all your favorite podcast platforms like Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Audible, iHeartRadio, Pandora, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Verbal.
For more on TritonCast, you can follow us on Twitter at TritonCast. And if you have suggestions for a future guest, send us a tweet or email Jenny and me at TritonCast@UCSD.edu. We'll see you back here next week.
You've been listening to TritonCast. TritonCast is a production of UC San Diego Athletics Communications. Please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast on your platform of choice. If you have show questions or comments or suggestions for future guests, email us at TritonCast@UCSD.edu. You can also follow the show on Twitter at TritonCast.